leaving the hotspot to build another mountain in its wake. Mount Achaia, two-thirds the height of Olympus Mons, is the most recently completed of these colossal construction projects, but Mount Achaia has since moved off the hotspot and will grow no more. Meanwhile, the hotspot is building a new volcano to the south, adding fresh real estate to the island of Hawaii. And yet another is forming on the ocean floor, destined perhaps to become a Hawaiian island of the future. But on Mars, Olympus Mons stayed put and grew to great height, indicating that the core of Mars wasn't hot enough to move the surface plates around. The extinct volcanoes of Mars are geological gravestones. 20 years after Viking, another probe landed on Mars. Pathfinder touched down in a dry river delta and examined rocks carried there from the highlands in the days when Mars had rivers and streams. Again, no signs of life were found. Long ago, it seems, something went terribly wrong on Mars. The rivers and streams evaporated or froze into the ground, the atmosphere thinned out, and the planet's ozone layer, if it ever had one, collapsed, exposing the surface to sterilizing solar ultraviolet light. The possibility remains, though, that life got started before this disaster occurred. If so, did it die out and leave fossils, or might life still be there, patiently hibernating in the rusty sands of Mars? The fact that life isn't conspicuous doesn't mean it's not there. There are dry valleys in Antarctica as desolate-looking as the landscapes of Mars. When the explorer Robert Scott discovered one such valley in 1903, he wrote that we have seen no sign of life, not even a moss or a lichen. Yet there is life there. Slowly growing microorganisms huddle in the frosty soil of Antarctica. Also to be found in the snows of the Antarctic are pieces of Mars, rocks knocked off the red planet that later fell to Earth. About a dozen such Mars meteorites have been recovered, and in one of them, researchers found what they considered to be fossils of Martian life. The evidence is preliminary at best, but it renewed interest in the tantalizing possibility that living organisms could have traveled around the early solar system, ferried aboard rocks that were blown off one planet and wound up on another. The origin of life. One way to investigate the origin of life is to look for places on Earth today where conditions approximate those that pertained back when life began. But where did life begin? On the ocean floor? On the surface, in volcanic hot springs? In tidal pools, with the first stirrings of evolution prompted perhaps by the rising and falling of tides, authored by the then-nearby moon? Or in volcanic hot springs, whether up top or on the ocean floor? And how did life begin? To find out, scientists are investigating the physics and chemistry of the early solar system. The sun's planets formed like slag heaps when boulders and gravel orbiting the sun were gathered together by gravitational attraction. Terrestrial life got started so early that the Earth was still being bombarded by cosmic debris when life began. The infant Earth was a violent place, its atmosphere a strange brew of methane and ammonia. Life has since refashioned the planet, making it more hospitable, and that's one of the problems about investigating how life originated. One has to think of the Earth not as it is now, but as it was then. Information stored in the genes of living creatures today suggests that life evolved from a single heat-loving ancestor, an organism that could cope with the volcanoes, sulfuric geysers, and meteorite storms of the early days. To learn what that ancestor was could bring us closer to understanding the origin of life. The heat-loving bacteria found in hot springs are among the oldest organisms on Earth, a clue that the earliest terrestrial life may have been nourished by the heat not of the sun, but of thermal vents generated by the Earth's molten core. Black smokers, as they're called, are hot, volcanic vents on the ocean floor. They host a rich variety of living organisms that get along in the darkness, sustained by geothermal energy. Other creatures like it cold. On the bottom of the Gulf of Mexico, researchers were startled to find worms living embedded in methane ice. The Ice Zone. The discovery that life can thrive in icy cold and hellish heat means that life need not have begun in a sunny, placid pond, as some had imagined, but might have arisen in the eternal night of the ocean depths, on Earth or any other world that has oceans and a molten core, no matter how far it is from the sun. So the habitable zone may be larger than anyone had realized. If the hot cores of geologically active worlds can sustain life in darkness, life could exist even among the icy outer planets where sunlight is weak. Jupiter, 5 times farther from the sun than the Earth is, receives only 1/25th as much sunlight. So Jupiter's satellites are cold, at least on the outside. Yet the icy surface of Jupiter's satellite Europa is marked by lanky fissures, cracks that suggest the presence of an ocean below that warms and replenishes the ice. Europa may have a molten core that keeps the ocean from freezing, and that could power life-sustaining deep-sea vents like black smokers here on Earth. We could find out by dispatching a lander to melt a hole in the ice and drop a submarine into the European Sea. The automated submarine could roam Europa's ocean for years, searching for signs of life. Farther out in the solar system are other icy moons that are cold on the outside but maybe hot inside. Among them, Neptune's satellite Triton and Saturn's satellite Enceladus. By sending probes to these mysterious moons, scientists can both search for life and study the primitive environments in which life arises. On Titan, the largest satellite of Saturn, a gentle rain of organic molecules is thought to fall amid conditions resembling those of the early Earth. A probe dispatched by the unmanned Cassini mission to Saturn was designed to search for clues to life's origins hidden beneath Titan's clouds. Jupiter's moon Io is a palpitating bag of lava. Scores of volcanoes pierce its grape-skin-thin surface. The Voyager spacecraft imaged a volcanic plume shooting into space from Io, and so decades later did the Galileo probe. 2 images made of the same spot on Io show a Texas-sized black splotch of volcanic eruption that wasn't there when the first photo was taken just 5 months earlier. Observations like these reveal that the geology of a volatile world like Io can be almost as changeable as the weather on Earth. The potential expansion of the habitable zone here in the solar system implies that life might thrive in other places that had been thought to be uninhabitable. There could be living creatures afloat in the atmospheres of gaseous planets like Jupiter. There could be life on young planets still entangled in the dark clouds from which they formed, or conceivably adrift in the clouds themselves, on internally heated planets beset by the winds of unstable suns, or on the freshly minted planets of hot young stars, on the ancient planets of old, steadily burning stars in globular clusters, or amid the fiery star-forming regions of colliding galaxies. There could be more life out there than we've ever imagined, for if the universe has taught us anything, it is that reality is richer and more resourceful than our wildest dreams. Terraforming. Life isn't fragile, it's tough. Here on Earth, life has endured heat, cold, and cataclysm, has emerged from the sea to inhabit the land and the air, and in human form has touched the moon. Someday we might carry the torch of life still farther outward to find a home on the planet Mars. If Mars proves to be sterile, we could make it suitable for life by transforming its environment through a global engineering project called terraforming. Terraforming Mars would mean providing the red planet with life's 3 requisites, water, energy, and organic molecules. There's some water there already, and human technology could provide the organics and boost the amount of available energy. In one plan, giant mirrors in space would warm the surface while genetically engineered plants and trees replenish the atmosphere. Eventually, the air would become breathable, and the great-great-grandchildren of the first colonists might fish and farm under the blue skies of a terraformed Mars. We humans once imagined that we were at the center of it all. Science has let the wind out of that vain claim. Cosmic maps show that we live closer to the edge than to the center of the galaxy, and genetic maps show us occupying the tip of just one branch of what's being called the shrub of life. We're not at the center of the universe, we're not at the top of the tree, but then neither is anyone else. And we're home, we're part of the universe. Yet we're also somehow apart from the universe, able to stand back and regard it objectively as intelligent observers. What does it mean to be intelligent, and how did intelligence originate here on Earth? Are there intelligent beings out among the stars? Will we ever be able to communicate with them, and if so, what would we say? Part 2. Is anybody listening? Visitors. Ours is a restless species, and in our wanderlust we have explored the globe and sent probes to look for life on some of the sun's other planets. But we're also a communicative species, and the way to search for life on the trillions of planets circling other suns may be through communication, if there are intelligent beings out there who want to communicate. If someday our descendants have explored the solar system as our predecessors explored the Earth, might they then venture onto the stars and set foot on the soil of an extrasolar planet? Can we sail through interstellar space as the mariners of old explored the islands of the sea? Or is it better to communicate by listening for messages from space and sending messages of our own? Any way you look at it, interstellar spaceflight is a daunting prospect. It's pretty roomy out there. If we could shrink the sun to the size of a single grain of salt, the Earth would be a microscopic grain orbiting at a distance of 1 inch, and the orbit of the planet Mars would lie within the palm of your hand. The whole solar system, the entire theater of wished-for human exploration for centuries to come, could be encompassed within the reach of your arms. Yet even on this tiny scale, the very nearest star would be more than 4 miles away, beyond the horizon. A futuristic starship might make the trip one day if we could figure out how to pay its titanic fuel bill and how to fire up its engines without frying the Earth in its exhaust, but interstellar spaceflight is likely to be expensive and slow. But if there are intelligent beings out there on the planets of other suns, we may be able to communicate with them even if they're too far away for us to visit them. Our own boldest explorations remind us that the stars are far away. The twin Voyager interstellar probes, launched in 1977, surveyed the giant outer planets and are now leaving the solar system. They carry a message, a gold-plated phonograph record containing music and sounds of Earth, for the benefit of any aliens who might one day intercept the space probes. Although the Voyagers fly 50 times faster than a jet fighter, they will take 70,000 years to reach another star. Ever since the Renaissance, when Galileo established that other planets exist, people have imagined that we would one day explore deep space. The astronomer Johannes Kepler wrote to Galileo that given the right ships and the right sails for space, there will be men who are not afraid of the terrible distances. Actually, the right ships already existed in embryonic form. Rockets began as a form of entertainment for the Chinese, who turned them into weapons of defense against the Mongols.